My name is Grover Furr, and I'm going to talk to you today about some basic concepts necessary for beginning to understand medieval literature and the society that produced it. Throughout this talk, I'm going to be referring to three web pages which you should have printed out and use more or less in the way of handouts. And each of these web pages is set up with some diagrams, and then the diagrams are explained in the text. I will make reference to these handouts or web pages as they go along, and you should also be following along with them as I talk. I'm going to follow more or less the schema outlined in these web page handouts and elaborate on it so that you'll come away with an introduction to medieval society and medieval ideas or ideology, and be able to refer back to it either by listening to this lecture again on your computer, or by referring to the handouts and your notes on them. The three handouts are called The Medieval Social Hierarchy Imagined and Real. That's the first. The second one is The Created Universe Understood by Analogy. And the third is The Geocentric or Ptolemaic Notion of the Universe. Now, all of these handouts refer frequently to one another. These ideas are related. There was a serious attempt made by medieval philosophers, who were also theologians, to systematize Christian knowledge, drawing upon previous Christian writers, and at the same time on the legacy of the pagan classical antiquity. And so this presentation is really an introduction to that system, enough of it at least so that you can begin to see how it's reflected in the literature, because without understanding something about this, these ideas and this way of looking at the world, this ideology, medieval literature is really impossible to understand correctly. I'm going to start with the handout called The Medieval Social Hierarchy Imagined as Real. On it, you'll see at the top a diagram. On the left-hand side, there's a triangle, an isosceles triangle, very regular, very idealized. At the peak, you see aristocracy, kings, nobles, higher clergy, and at the bottom, peasantry, everybody else. In the diagram, I've mentioned that, on the handout, I call the diagram on the left The Medieval Society as Imagined by Medieval Writers. On the right-hand side, you'll notice a kind of graph diagram that nevertheless roughly resembles in some ways the diagram on the left-hand side, and this is meant to represent a medieval society as contemporary historians look at it. That is to say, if you take the y-axis, which represents the greater or lesser wealth, power, and status, the x-axis representing numbers of people, you'll see that on the graph on the right, a very large amount of wealth, power, and status is held by a very small number of people, and as you go down to the x-axis, you'll notice that a very small amount of wealth, power, and status is represented by a very large number of persons. So that what I want to suggest with these diagrams is that the schematization on the right-hand side, which is a kind of modern, scientific, or objective way of plotting certain facts about medieval society, nevertheless has some resemblance to the idealized diagram on the left, because the idealized diagrams reflect the fact that a very small number of people, represented by the the narrow apex of the collateral triangle, a very small number of people have the power and the wealth and the authority, and a much larger number of people represented by the base of the triangle have very little. And the diagram on the left also represents the fact that authority flows from top to bottom. The aristocracy, a small number of people have a great deal of authority, a very large number of people have very little authority. So it's important to recognize that the medieval concept, the elite, educated medieval person's conception of his own society, he was a he, though it's idealized and very inaccurate in many respects, as we'll see, is not completely divorced from reality. It's not completely false, and nobody would have believed it if it had been completely false. It does reflect in a general and abstract way the basic power relations in medieval society. If you take the graph on the right, normally you only see a graph in one quadrant, and that would be the top right-hand quadrant. And what I've suggested in the text here is if you were to draw this graph in the top right quadrant, this curve with very wet ink, and then fold the diagram along the y-axis, so that you've sort of got another diagram created on the other side, then you get a diagram that looks something like a curved kind of triangle, and that's simply to represent the relation between the medieval reality and the idealized reflection of it in medieval ideology. Well, what held medieval society together? Shared values hold every society together. In that sense, medieval society is similar to those of today, the societies today. I'll point out in the handout that today these values are mainly secular political notions, such as democracy, equal opportunity, freedom, and so on. In other words, ideas that resonate with a contemporary population and make people think that their society is legitimate. Ultimately, of course, all societies are held together by force, the force of those who control the society. But in medieval society and in the ancient world, as today, no society can really be held together by force alone, or even mainly by force, because the ruled are too many and the rulers are too few. So therefore, loyalty to certain ideas is what holds societies together. The medieval society was held together by ideas which we can recognize as political, but which are also religious, and explicitly such. Religious values are also important today, but they were much more important in the Middle Ages, when there really was no secular political or social philosophy. The social hierarchy in the Middle Ages was said to be good because it was ordained by God, and it was said or thought to conform more or less imperfectly with the hierarchy of the created universe which God created. Obedience flows upwards, authority flows downwards. Those who need to obey are on the bottom, those who to whom obedience is owed and who have power and wealth and status are on the top. And this, of course, was thought to be a direct reflection of the divine will, since it was analogous to the relationships in the universe itself, where God commanded and everything and everybody else obeyed, or at least ideally. This notion of analogy, the theorized reflection, however imperfect, of divine, the divine will, the divine hierarchies in earthly society, is a fundamental idea in medieval thought and medieval ideology, and we have to keep it in mind and learn to to thinking in this new way. And I say a little something about the two kinds of love. The first kind is caritas, or divine love, as Dante said in the last lines of the Paradiso, l'amore, love, che muove il sole e l'altre stelle, love that moves the sun and the other stars. Now, love meant God-ordained relationships between God and his creations. The force binding the universe together was said to be love. Divine love, God's will, if you wish, kept the sun, moons, planets, and stars rotating in their place around the earth, and also divinely ordained hierarchical ordinate relationships were said to be reflections of God's love for his creation and his creatures, especially man. So the king or prince shows his love by exercising just authority, by ruling justly, while the peasantry or the subjects show love by submitting humbly to this rule, even when it is unjust. In this sense, it was as Dante said, love, understood as God's love, moved the heavenly bodies, kept them in their place, just as love kept the medieval subjects in their place in society. Now, one corollary of this, important implication, is anyone attempting to change social relationships or doing things that resulted in a threat to social relationships was acting contrary to the will of God in an unloving or hateful manner. So it's important to understand this concept of divine love served to support a highly exploitative and authoritarian social structure. Once again, we see that the political value of traditional Christian ideology was and is highly conservative, even reactionary. That is to say, there's a political valence to all of these theological ideas, one which is very important to understand. Medieval Christianity, medieval Catholicism, justifies and reflects the hierarchical relationships of inequality and exploitation that existed in medieval society. And therefore, a virtuous Christian would not question these fundamental relationships. The second kind of love, of course, is sinful love, often represented by the Latin word cupiditas. You can see the term Cupid there, and that's significant. But the basic notion, of course, is it comes from the Latin word cupido, which means to desire. Cupiditas, lust, or sinful love. Any attempt to change social relationships was by definition bad because it was a challenge to a violation of, a contravention even, of God's love. That is to say, an attempt to create an ungodly state of affairs. Any attempt to change social relations was a sin, because a sin is by definition anything that goes contrary to God's will. Sin, therefore, is a lack of love, a lack of the correct kind of love, of charity, divine love. Or to put it another way, hatred, which of course is also a lack of love, right? The opposite of love. Or to put it another important way, lust. A carnal, that is fleshly, love. A love according to the flesh, not according to reason. Because the imagined medieval social hierarchy, the diagram at the left above, stands in an analogous relationship to all the other divine hierarchies. And we're going to take a look at this in a little while. Divine or spiritual or rational love pertains to the reason, as carnal, earthly, fleshly love pertains to the flesh. Now notice the use of analogy here. Caritas, or charity, is to cupiditas, or sinful love, or cupidity, or lust, or greed, as reason is to the flesh, as man is to woman, as the king is to his kingdom, as Adam is to Eve, as God is to his creative universe, and so on. This is how the system of analogies works.